Looking at the person of Jesus, today we see some of his claims and the way in which people responded to him. Because within any group, there are people who are ignorant, just do not have the information, do not know, and there are those who are informed about a particular topic, who do know about it, and have come to some informed opinion, but there are also those who ignore the information that is available to them. Being people committed to tertiary education, although as the session goes on our level of commitment varies, but being people who at this stage are committed to tertiary education, we're committed to an assumption about life that we should make decisions on the basis of information. It's the way in which we do almost anything, and it's because of the kind of people we are. It's not an assumption I particularly want to quarrel with, but it is an assumption that lies behind much of what I'll be saying today, so I thought I might as well spell it out, because I know that you'll already agree with it. You see, I'm considering buying a new car because my ashtray's full on the present one. And so I've gone around looking at cars and tried to work out what kind of car I would need, you know, what kind would produce bigger ashtrays. And having settled on a particular kind of car, I then went off to the NRMA and asked them if they had any road tests on it. So I was supposed to find out, and they said they hadn't got any, but there was one in Wheels magazine, so I went and bought a Wheels magazine and read all the technical information, and then I went off and got a friend to explain it to me because I didn't understand what it was. And having got all that information and the rest of it, I rang up the people and found out how much it cost, and I've worked out I can drive a car with a full ashtray fairly easily. Now, I've made a decision, but I've made decisions on the basis of information. That is how I proceed in life. That is how you proceed in life, isn't it? So when you come to make decisions, we seek information rather than basing decisions on ignorance. Now, of course, you can't do that on every decision of life, otherwise you'll go around the bend just trying, you never decide to do anything. There are too many decisions to be made. So you do it on the big decisions. The bigger the decision, the more you look out the information and make sure that you've got as much information that is available. Whereas on little decisions as to whether I'll have mustard or tomato sauce on my hot dog today, that kind of decision I can make just purely prejudicially. You know, just prefer one colour against another. You really don't even have to think about it. In fact, I just won't have a hot dog. It's simple, you see, to make those kinds of decisions. Now, the claims of Jesus are of such character as to require us to search out the information, because he is making not small and minor claims, but large ones. But many people make their decisions about Jesus based on ignorance. Most people have made up their decision about God by the time they dropped out of Sunday school in the Australian culture, which was around the age of 10, 11 or 12. In other words, without ever having thought about the great abstract ideas involved in Christianity, because by and large their minds weren't capable of abstract thinking, without having reached that stage, they've already made their decision about that. And they very frequently have not read the New Testament, ever actually taken into account. Certainly they haven't done it as an adult mind, but they have made up their mind, they have made up their decision about life, its meaning, its purpose, its values, and what God has to do with it. Big decisions are made in a position of almost total ignorance. Now, I'm glad you have made the step at least to come in this day to listen to a little bit, to be informed, and we hope and encourage that you'll be informed further. We've put inside the outlines of today's study, the blue sheet which gives the outline of the address and the topics we're going through, cards in which we encourage you to write questions for us, offer to ask us whether we'll meet up with you. If you put your name and address and tick the little box down the bottom, we'll be glad to do a series of studies with you, four one-hour studies at your convenience and time and place to investigate further that you might have information. We've also got up the back there a stall which we're selling some books. We're giving away Bibles there. If you don't have one, you need to have one. We're happy for you to have them. Or tapes we've got up there. If you want to know what is a Christian, how to become one, we've done out a special tape exactly answering that question and so on. We want you to be informed so that you can make a decision on the basis of information about Jesus. You see, ignorance is all right, provided it's ignorance and not ignoring. There's a big difference between ignorance and ignoring. See, ignorance is something that is excusable. Ignoring something is something that is not excusable. You know, you can say, well, I couldn't help it, I didn't know. Now, ignorance, it's a great claim. It's not my fault, I didn't know about it. But if you remember, the law says ignorance is no excuse. No excuse before the law. Why is that? Well, because the law is public. And it's your duty and responsibility as a citizen to know what the law says. There's no point saying to the policeman when he pulls you over, look, I didn't know I had to drive on the left-hand side of the road. I thought the right-hand side or the left, just depending how I felt, would be the way to do it. I didn't know the law. That is an irrelevance at that point, isn't it? I didn't know I had to drive below 100 kilometres, below 60 kilometres an hour down George Street. I thought I could drive at 150. I mean, why couldn't I if I want to? It really is of no value to you. Ignorance is of no value because the law is public. The only way you can be ignorant is by ignoring it. And ignoring is of a different moral character, a different character of position completely than just being ignorant. Now, Christianity is something that many, many people in our community, the majority, I would suggest to you, of people, ignore. They're not ignorant, and therefore claim some possibility of excuse. They're ignorant because they ignore what is being said, and they ignore for lots of reasons. Because it's inconvenient, because it's maybe unpleasant, because it may be costly, it may challenge them to change, because it's socially unacceptable in certain contexts. But because of unpleasantness, which will interrupt the commitment to apathy, because of unpleasantness, it's easier to ignore the issue than it is to seek out the information and make up your mind, which is what we do with other matters. It's just easier. I remember a man whom I invited to a meeting, not unlike this one, a friend of mine, who said to me, and I no doubt that he said it in all honesty, he says, no, I won't come, because if I come and find out it's to be true, I'd have to change too much. And there you see, he's a man who is ignoring the facts. You can't help but think that he must suspect that they're true in the first place, can you? That he is so worried about looking at it. He only had 4 university degrees, and the thing that really worried him about changing too much was that he was earning a lot of money, and he suspected that Christians would ask him to give it up. And another man who said he knew it was true about Jesus Christ, but he didn't want to become a Christian and didn't want to talk about it any further with me, because becoming a Christian would put him in such difficulty with his mates at work that he really would rather not know about it. See, there are people who are just ignoring it. Now, I'm preaching to the converted, aren't I? You're not ignoring it. You made the effort. You're coming. I mean, you could be sitting there with blank minds at the moment, just planning out the weekend, and if that's the case, then you're ignoring it in a very sophisticated fashion. But you're not ignoring it. You're here. But I'm suggesting to you, friends, we can even come along and inquire in such a way as to make sure we never find the answer. That too is possible, isn't it? Because we can ignore in lots of ways. In lots of ways. We can say that's just a subject that's forbidden, and there are some families, there are some schools, there are some places where it's just a forbidden subject to talk about religion. But we can ignore it by putting on a show of investigating when it's really cynicism. We're not actually inquiring in order to find out whether it's true or not. We're inquiring so as to find out that it's not true. That is the mindset in which we have. Some, of course, will investigate it by making sure they look at anything but Jesus. Let's discuss the church and what's wrong with the church. That'll take us for the rest of our lifetime, so we never have to bother about Jesus, do we? There are many ways of ignoring the claims, but the claims are great. Look at chapter 9 here, verse 39, and you see the claim of Jesus there. He says, I have come for judgment into this world, so that the blind will see, and those who see will become blind. Jesus comes for judgment. He comes to bring division, to force the issue, to force you to make up your mind to be one who identifies yourself as blind or sighted, but he comes to divide the community in which he occurs. And that is what happens. See, on the back of the outline, I'll be praying a prayer later on, which I pray each week. I prayed it last week. The last sentence of which is, please forgive me and change me that I may live with Jesus as my Lord and Master. One of the anonymous cards that we got in last week, I think on the Friday of last week, says this, it seems totally repulsive for me to live with Jesus as my Lord and Master, as the prayer on the back and the study seems goes on. See, that is a repulsive idea to the person. I can understand it being a repulsive idea. It depends on who you think Jesus is as to whether that's a good idea or a repulsive idea, isn't it? If you think, as this man did, that Jesus was the Son of Man, when he believes in verse 37, notice what he does, 38 rather, the man said, Lord, I believe, and he worshipped him. He treated Jesus as his God. Why? Because he believed that Jesus was God. If you believe Jesus is God, then you must have him as your Lord and Master. That's the only appropriate way of treating God, to have him as your Master. But of course, if you believe that Jesus is a Jewish man of the first century whose now bones and ashes are all moulded away in some unmarked Palestinian grave, if that's who you think he is, then to have that as your Lord and Master is utterly repulsive. And if you think that you are God, then to have anybody as your Lord and Master is utterly repulsive. So Jesus, you see, in his claims actually divides us. It divides us right down the middle as to those who would want to live their life for him as opposed to living their life for themselves or for something else or somebody else. And it depends on who you think he is. And that, of course, that decision should be based on the information you have and your investigation of that information. Some years ago, I met a visiting Canadian professor who was out here on sabbatical. I met up with him for social reasons that I won't go into, which were quite funny. But we spent some time together, and his family and mine. We had some picnics in the park and all that kind of thing. And a lovely family. And at the end of that year, they wrote back to us because of Thanksgiving. The marvellous North American custom is Thanksgiving, as this family practices it each year, so the letter tells me. They sit down and think through all the good things that had happened to them through the last 12 months. And then they wrote off and thanked people for those parts. And so they wrote off and thanked us for our hospitality. Isn't that a nice thing for Australians to actually have a Thanksgiving practice, would it? Anyway, he writes saying thank you. Now, he was a man who was not a Christian and was known actually to be quite cynical of Christianity in the staff room he was working in here. He gave a Christian friend of mine considerably hard time in the staff room. However, he wrote to me, because we'd had many discussions on the subject, "The more heavily involved in science I've become, the more convinced I am that there is some divine plan underlying all of nature. Only a scientist can see the magnificent order of the universe, decide that science can explain that order, and then come to the stunning realization that it could not possibly have occurred by chance." He goes on, "In my own general field of sensory and perceptual processes, I encounter examples of this magnificent order time and time again, and it never fails to impress me. I certainly cannot dispute the facts of evolutionary development, but neither can I dispute the fact that all of this did not happen by chance or by accident. The inescapable conclusion is that some divine creator has guided the evolution of the universe. The problem I have," he goes on, "the problem for me in religion is not in accepting the notion of divine intervention. The facts of science shout that out. Rather, my problem is accepting the divinity of Jesus. I realize," this and goes on, "I guess what I'm having difficulty with is in bridging the gap between evidence and belief, between facts and faith. My belief in a divine creator is reinforced by the facts of science. I do not have the same facts supporting the divinity of Christ. I'm not even necessarily seeking them, but as a scientist I have difficulty in accepting things for which I do not have scientific evidence. If there are books I can read to help me resolve this difficulty, I would appreciate your directing me to them." And then, so the letter goes on about Carol and the kids and so on. I wrote back and told him that there are all kinds of good books, and I gave him a list of some of them. This new book by Fresh Start hadn't come out in those days, so I couldn't tell him about that, but I'd tell you about it. Free advertisement any time, you see. And so I wrote to him telling him about basic Christianity and so on, and suggesting the best one was the New Testament. He should give that a try. Now, there is a man, you see, who has certain evidences before him that he's investigated because of his field in scientific investigation, that has come to a conclusion about God. But he hasn't got the evidence about Jesus. And so he writes asking to find out about it, to get a book list, to actually do some research and some reading, to find out whether there are evidence to show that Jesus is God or not. Because on the basis of that, your action should follow in treating him, in calling upon him to be your Lord and Master. Here is a man who perceives that what Jesus claims requires investigation. Now, it's that kind of issue that is thrown up to us throughout chapter 9 of John's Gospel. For it really picks up the issue of people's response to Jesus, especially the attempts of some people to ignore the evidence and the reasons why they seek to ignore the evidence. It starts off with what we would call a miracle, what the New Testament calls, what John calls, a sign. Here is a man born blind and whom Jesus cures. Now, for some of us, as soon as you mention the word miracle, there's a problem. You see, we've got such a closed order system of nature that we cannot believe anything should happen that doesn't fit in with our understanding of how it should happen. So we rule it out as impossible from the word go. For others of us, we want some kind of explanation. We say, well, it could have happened, but there must be some sleight of hand, or maybe it was just a psychosomatic blindness, or some other explanation, all done with mirrors, as my father says. Now, the New Testament really plays, the John's Gospel, I should say, in particular, has very little emphasis on what we call about miracles. You see, we are people who are terribly worried about the evidence for the supernatural. And so we think miracles are very important because of their evidence for the supernatural. But that's not the point Jesus is making or John is making. People are not doubting the supernatural as such, as some in our community have doubted it. And indeed, Jesus constantly refuses to do miracles in order to demonstrate his supernatural power. People ask him to do it and he won't do it. As Superstar rightly picks it up, you see, he wouldn't walk across Herod's swimming pool. He's not in the game of party tricks. He's not Uri Geller making money out of bending spoons. That's not what it's about. He does some miracles, but he always does them for a purpose and a point. And John records them because of the purpose and the point. In fact, though Jesus did hundreds and hundreds, and we read of many, many thousands of people being cured by him, and friends and foes alike all agreed that he did those miracles, or he did great miracles, whatever explanation you want to give to them, John only records for us half a dozen or so of them. He records very, very few. And when he records them because they are signs of something else. It's the symbolic importance of them that roots us here. And we mustn't lose sight of that. Now, I'm not suggesting for a moment that I don't believe that the blind man was made better by Jesus. I believe he was. The evidence I've got for it is exactly the evidence sitting in front of you. No more, no less. It says that that's what happened. But I'm saying is the important point is the symbol, is the significance of a blind man seeing. For who is the blind man, you see, and what is it about? Chapter 9, verse 5, Jesus says, I am the light of the world. That's what he's talking about. He comes as light. And throughout the gospel we have this contrast between light and darkness. Light symbolizing knowledge and good and life and sight, and darkness symbolizing ignorance and evil and death and sickness. And the light-darkness contrast, as a symbolic way of talking, as a dualistic way of talking, runs through the gospel, through the whole of the 20 chapters of this book, as a way of explaining the conflict of the two kingdoms that is involved in the person of Jesus. And he comes as the light, specifically and especially the one who gives life, but part of that is being sight. And here is a man who is blind. Oh, he's alive, but his life is so hampered by blindness as to be really in the kingdom of death. And Jesus is liberating him from that and going on to show that those who have got sight, namely the Pharisees, they're actually the ones who are really blind. And so he comes bringing light to the blind and bringing blindness to those who can see. He actually divides man and see, it's a metaphor of the whole action of salvation, of the whole process of bringing in the kingdom of God. It's a metaphor, it's its symbolic importance is why it is recorded for us here. The blind man has got the obvious physical disadvantage of life without sight, which we can understand and we can feel for him about. But it has more than that. He's a beggar. He is actually economically in the margin. For most of us, we haven't lived there and we don't understand how dreadful life is when you have to depend upon other people like that. How dreadful life can be in economic deprivation is hard for us to grasp hold of, because we've always lived, even as students, with so much money as to not be living like this. He's around the temple begging because Jews were under the law that they had to give when they went to the temple. So that's the best place to beg, isn't it? It's a fairly good spot to beg. And so he's there begging by the temple. But by the temple makes it even more poignant, because the Jewish man who was blind was not allowed to go into the temple. He was actually excluded from the religion of Israel. Now, can you understand the hurt that is the poignancy of being there? It's the place to go because you get the money, but all the time you are reminded that you are an outcast from God and God's people. You can't participate fully because of your physical handicap. It's more than physical. It's even more than economic and socially alienating. It is even a spiritual alienation. And you pick it up because there is such a close connection in their minds between sin and sickness, between the judgment of God and sickness, that somebody who is blind must have done something very evil. But this one's been born blind. So what is it that he did that could be so evil? Or was it his parents evil? And you see that in the very first verse there. You see, as he went along, as Jesus went along, he saw a man blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? So the assumption is there, isn't it? They know sin must have been involved, but now you've got to work out which one. Oh, only a week or two ago here in Sydney, there was a psychiatrist from Edinburgh that I heard interviewed on, I think it was the AM show, who was again linking sin, and in his particular case he was linking the idea of people who were dead and hadn't been buried properly and things like that coming back and causing all kinds of illnesses, including certain mental illnesses and the like, you see. The ideas of connecting up sin and sickness, very common. One of our cards that came in last week that I was going to comment on this week really picks it up. Is illness due to the sins or shortcomings of a person in any way? That is, shortcomings as far as what God expects of us. Another one of our anonymous cards that came in. And you see, it's that question, isn't it? What has this person done wrong to have been born blind? Or what has his parents done? Jesus won't have that. Jesus won't wear it at all. This man's not been blind for that reason, or because of his parents. It's got nothing to do with that. It's got to do with God's purposes being worked out in this world, but it's not got to do with his sin. But do grasp hold of what it was to be blind. See, we see a blind person and we can understand the physical missing out in life, but realise it was more than physical, it was economic. And it was more than economic, it was social. It was more than social, it was spiritual, in terms of not being in the temple, but it was also in terms of the whole attitude that everybody had towards that person, which he would have had towards himself, that he was particularly and specifically cursed by God because of some sin that he did or his parents did. And you see it reflected in verse 34, where the Pharisees say to him, you were steeped in sin at birth. How dare you lecture us? That is the way in which that man lived. He's alive, but what kind of life is it he's living? And Jesus gives to that man sight so that he can now see. And he becomes then a symbol for us of what Jesus comes to do, to bring people who are under the curse of God out of that, bring people who are under the death and social ostracism out of that, to bring people into fellowship with God's people and God himself through the work of Jesus, to actually save the lost. That is what he has come to do. But those who are already on the in, those who already think they are safe with God, they are put in danger by this. That is, the good people of this world, the good, moral, upright, religious kinds of people of this world, are always the ones who find Jesus most unacceptable. Whereas the lost, the desperate, those who are cut off from God and God's people and know it, they are the ones who are most keen to hear about Jesus. The Pharisees, the religious, moral, middle-class businessmen, the Rotarians of the first century, they reject Jesus consistently. Whereas the drunkards, the prostitutes, the down-and-outs, they were glad to hear of the message of Jesus and seeking after him. That is still the case, friends, which of course puts us in terrible dangers, because by and large most of us don't perceive ourselves in the drunkard and prostitute class. Most of us perceive ourselves in a very different class and category of life. And we find it hard to want somebody who is offering us sight, because we want to say, but I've got sight already. I know where I'm at. I know what life's about. I know where I'm going. I have the world at my feet and I'm going to put it there and keep it there. And therefore, in our own self-made status, we find it hard to accept somebody else who may be able to give us far greater life than we've ever imagined. The responses to Jesus... Jesus comes in judgment then, in division. It comes in that last little section particularly. You see it, verse 35. Jesus found the man who'd been then kicked out of the synagogue, and he said, do you believe in the Son of Man? The Son of Man is a picture of the Old Testament. You find it in Daniel if you want to find it, chase it up. Daniel chapter 7. Of the judgment day. In the judgment day, in the last day at the end of the world, God is going to give all judgment to a person whom is called the Son of Man. And this person is going to rule over the universe for the rest of eternity. Nothing more is much said about this one who is the Son of Man, but he is there. So the Jews were looking forward to the coming of the Son of Man, looking forward to the judgment day when the Son of Man, whoever he is, will rule the world for eternity. Jesus says to the blind man, well, do you believe in the Son of Man? He says, well, yeah, I believe in the Son of Man, but who is he? To which Jesus says, the one you have been speaking to. I am the Son of Man. At that, the man who is blind and can now see really sees and says, I believe in him. And he worshipped him. This is the kind of claims of Jesus. He has come to bring judgment because he is the Son of Man. He makes claims which people are either going to have to accept or spurn. He makes claims to such divinity that you either worship him as God or reject him as a fraud. That is the kind of options he gives you, no others. If what he is saying is true, then the whole purpose and meaning of life is to be found in him. If what he said to be true is false, then it is a monstrous hoax. When you look into the chapter, all kinds of attitudes come. First of all, there's the ignorance. You see, the blind man didn't know who he was talking to. He knew it was Jesus, but he didn't realise that it was the Son of Man until Jesus made himself known. The crowds don't know. They're always confused in the Gospel of John. They didn't even know whether it was the blind man or not. They'd never really looked. I mean, there's all kinds of people you never look at, aren't there? And beggars are particularly the kinds you never look at, never closely. And they'd never really looked at this man before, but now that he's walking around with sight, they look at him and say, yeah, I think that's the man, only I wish he'd just sit down in the dirt again over in the corner, because I only know what he looks like from the top. You know, I've never really actually been face to face with him before. He's a non-person. So it's like trying to remember what grey men look like around the university. You see, they're non-persons to most students. They're not real humans. They're just there. It's a dreadful way in which they are treated by undergraduates. Could make an effort today to say hello to a grey man, will you? Just to smile and treat them like humans would be a pleasant relief for them, and it wouldn't do you any harm either. Because they're non-persons, because we just don't pay attention to those kinds of people. Blind men, we're not sure this is the right one or not. He identifies himself clearly enough. But it's the way in which the religious people ignore him which stands out in this chapter. Ignore him they do, though, because they say, Jesus couldn't be the right man because he's done the healing on the wrong day. See, it's a classic way of ignoring people. He doesn't fit into our religious preconceptions. They have a Sabbath day, which they've got out of God's law, but which they've built up a whole set of rules and regulations, part of which would be that you're not allowed to spit in clay and make a bit of clay and heal a person on the day. I mean, that's like starting up a whole new brick industry, isn't it? I mean, that's clearly working. You mustn't do that. I mean, fancy practicing medicine. And most likely without being a member of the AMA either. And there he is practicing medicine on the wrong day of the week. It cannot be right. He cannot be from God. The fact that man who has been born blind can now see, has now been restored to God's people in the fellowship of the temple services of worshipping God, the fact that that whole man's life has been saved, that doesn't really matter as the fact that it was on the wrong day of the week. So far have they moved. But you see, people's religious background, commonly, even today, mean that they will not accept Jesus. They will not look at the facts and evidence about Jesus. We often have seen people who have been converted here at university go home and tell their family and find out that they're totally unacceptable, that Christian faith. I know a man whose sons were converted, and this man was an Anglican. And his sons went home and said they had become Christians. The father, instead of being glad at such a thing, was horrified because they'd become Christians through the activities of a Baptist preacher. And the father said that they couldn't have become Christians because it was a Baptist who was preaching. You see, now there is a classic piece of religious prejudice, isn't it? I'm not going to weigh up what's true or not, what they heard or didn't hear. If it was coming from the mouth of a Baptist, it couldn't have been the truth. Some of you will readily agree with that today, I hope not. But that is we get people. There was a man who was converted here a few years ago, an undergraduate, who went home to tell his parents about wanting to go to church. His parents were horrified that he wanted to go to church. They hadn't been to church for over 20 years, not at all. And he identified which church he wanted to go to, and the father was even more horrified. And he said, if you're going to turn religious, at least you could have the decency to turn my religion. He hadn't been for over 20 years, but he still had his preferences. And indeed, he wouldn't accept what the man was saying, what the student was saying about, because it didn't fit into the categories. It's not right. You've got to be actually in the right denomination, haven't you? What a nonsense it is. What an absolute nonsense. Can't listen to Jesus because he's doing the healings on the wrong day of the week. Or again, there is the cynicism that you see in the Pharisees. They've got to check out the parents in verse 18. Is this really the man that was born blind? I mean, or is there someone in collusion? He's doing a trick. Jesus is just, is this really the bloke? And the parents say, yes, there's no doubt about it. That's our son. Now, at one level, that's good. And I'm glad it happened. Because it helps us perceive that first century people weren't gullible fools, just believing anything that happened. They actually did check it out. The crowds checked out whether it was the man. The Pharisees even went further and checked out whether it was the man by checking other witnesses, very important witnesses as to who the person is, namely the parents of the person. So there were some efforts to check. But the Pharisees are not just checking. They're actually checking to disprove. And you see it come out and say, verse 26, 27. They asked the blind man who now can see, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? The blind man answered, I have told you already, and you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? And then with tongue in cheek he says, do you want to become his disciples too? To which he gets the bad reaction. Now, not surprising. It's a very funny story, actually, chapter 9. It's well worth reading again and again. It's very funny, the little interplay. But you see what he's saying about them. You keep asking the same questions over and over and over and over, not because you want to find the answer, but because you want to continue to be unbelieving about him. And that is the case, you see. People want to ask questions, but they don't really want to find answers. They just want to blow off the question. I had a bloke come and interview me from the ABC the other day who consistently asked me questions, and before I answered, moved on to the next question. Never actually let me answer any of the questions because he wasn't interested. And I said to him that the students today had become Christians, and it was still happening today. You could have people becoming Christians. And he said, oh, well, youthful idealism, isn't it? Pressed on. You see, all I've got to do is, by having youthful idealism, I'm not youthful anymore. I don't have to be idealistic, and therefore I don't have to listen to anything about Jesus Christ. But he spent the whole time asking me questions. It always looked as if he was interested in the answers, but in fact he was never interested in any answers. He'd already made his mind up. There is that cynicism. Investigate by all means. We want you to investigate. We want to help you in any way that you can nominate to us that we can help you in investigating. But investigate to find out the truth, not to disprove something. Not be cynical. Then, of course, there's censorship. In verse 22, they had been warned that anybody who professed Jesus was the Christ would be kicked out of the synagogue, would be actually excluded from the community. Censorship is still available today. It's very widely available on the subject of Jesus. There is official, formal, legal censorship in some nations. Some of you, especially overseas students, know that being baptised while you're here in Australia will give you terrible troubles back at home. Some of you actually can't go home if you go to certain countries if you're being baptised. There are some countries in which you cannot go and run Bible studies like this on a university campus. It is against the law of the country. It is against the rules of the university. It will not be allowed to take place. There are many countries that are like that. But it's not only overseas and somewhere else, it's here in Australia as well. A couple of nights ago, one of my friends talked to me about the fact that he was trying to advertise some Bible studies in one of the ethnic newspapers in Sydney. But the ethnic newspaper refused his advertisements, would not accept them, even though he was paying for them, the going public rate. They will not actually take his advertisements. And the ethnic radio will not play any of the professionally produced shows that he has made. Why? Because that ethnic group doesn't accept Christianity in the way in which he wants to, namely by teaching the Bible. That ethnic community has already got a religious foundation which is very strong, and therefore you're not even allowed to advertise in their newspaper. Oh, you can advertise all kinds of other things in their newspaper. Oh, you call girls and the rest. You can advertise almost anything. But you try and advertise the study of the Bible, and you can't. Censorship is very widely available. It's available inside your own community, inside your own family, aren't there? There are kids who have become Christians here on campus who have been excluded from their family, and for whom we've had to find alternative accommodation because their parents have said, you cannot believe in Jesus and like you do and be in my family. And there are many others to whom it won't go quite to that extent. It just goes and says, in terms of, we do want you not to be a fanatic, not to go to church. There are people who come to Bible study here every week who come here because their parents say they're not to go to church on Sundays. Censorship is very widely available, friends. And you can see why it is easier to ignore Jesus than to face up to that kind of hostility, that kind of pressure at home or in the workplace or amongst your friends. Certainly, you see, fear is a great reason for ignoring Jesus. That's what the parents of the blind man did. They've got that classic statement there. You see it where it's in verse 21. How he can see now, or who opened his eyes, we don't know. There's the claim for ignorance. We're ignorant. They weren't ignorant. They knew very well how it had happened. But they just found it easier to ignore Jesus. Ask him. He is of age. He'll speak for himself. The classic fear terror of what is going to take place. You see, the consequences are always things that we are fearful of in becoming Christian. There was a psychologist who used to come to Bible study with us here, between jobs he was, and he'd become a Christian. And he said to me that he had known that Jesus was true since his undergraduate days, and for 7 years he knew that Christianity was true, but he hadn't become a Christian. I asked him why. He said, because I was always fearful that I was going to have to give up something. I said, what was it? He said, I never knew what it was, but I knew it would be something. And so for 7 years, on the grounds that there would be something that he may have to give up, he didn't become a Christian. When he finally became a Christian, I said, well, what was it that you had to give up? He said, nothing, really. And I said, you mean your life hasn't changed? He said, oh, it's changed, but all for the better, none for the worse. I can't think that I've given up anything that I had to give up. So I said, what was it then? He said, I don't know. It's just within myself. I knew that I'd have to give up something. I was fearful of it. And so although I knew it was true all that time, he said, I used to just avoid it like the plague. I wouldn't talk to people about it. I wouldn't go near anybody who was going to mention Jesus because I knew it was true, but I didn't want it. I was fearful. But the real one is pride. At the end of the chapter, you see it with the Pharisees. They're saying, and here lies at the base of so many of these things, are you saying we're blind too? Is that the reason? See, some years ago we ran a campaign called No Christ, No Life. That's N-O Christ, N-O Life. And we had a debate with one of the lecturers here in the philosophy department who wasn't a Christian and who was willing to debate with us and very kindly. And he said that he was happy to share in the debate. And he opened up his address along these lines. He was happy to share in the debate. But he was unhappy to be associated with a program which said No Christ, No Life, because he took it as a personal insult to actually say that people did not have life who didn't have Jesus Christ. And he went on at great length telling us how insulting it was to say such a thing as no Christ, no life. In fact, he found it so insulting he really couldn't listen to us. It has to do with pride. Here are people saying, look, you are missing out on all the best things of life. Find out about Christ so that you may know what life is about. But he is so upset by saying you're missing out about the things of life. He is so caught up in his own pride that he has got all the things of life that he will not listen to what is being offered. Clergyman, minister, priest, a clergyman spoke to me about it because some students had said to him that they had been born again. And they had challenged him about it. And they said, why didn't you teach us about being born again? Is it because you don't know about being born again? Have you been born again? He was furious when he spoke to me on the subject. Arrogant young whippersnappers was his phrase. Impudent, rude. What right have they got to me to ask me if I've been born again? I've been ordained for 10, 15 years. I can't remember how many it was now. And I am an ordained minister of the church. And they are coming and asking me, have I been born again? You see, such is the character of pride that he never actually asked the question himself. It was more important that he was preserving his status than it was for him finding out whether he'd been born or not. The nature of pride, those who claim to have sight so often are blinded because of what Jesus is saying. Jesus is saying your life is unsatisfactory and I've come to give you real life. If you're so proud that you cannot hear someone saying that to you, then you will be blinded indeed. The chapter gives us examples of people who are being informed and finding out the case of the young man who is blind and now sees. My friend from Canada wrote back to me a year after that first letter that I've just read to you, a year and a few months. And he writes, I should also mention that I've read the books which you suggested, but as you suspected, the one from which I've derived the greatest benefit is the New Testament. I read it before, but I had not read with the same sense of perspective, and it's almost like reading it anew. In fact, I find new insights even in passages I've read many times. It really is the greatest book ever written. Needless to say, I no longer have any difficulty in accepting the divinity of Christ. He's a man who wanted information, who asked for it, who were given books, and I didn't speak to him again for 12, 15 months, but who read the books, especially the New Testament, and came to his conclusions about the divinity of Jesus. What's your conclusions? There are a couple of courses of action ahead for us. One is, if you are ignorant and need to be informed about Jesus, or partially ignorant, and need to be informed about Jesus, we want to help you. Come again next week, we're going to talk more about Jesus. But also, why not do one of the little courses we've devised? There's this little course, only 4 studies. We'd love to do it with you. All you need to do is drop your name and address on that blue card and tick the box next to the word yes. We'll ring you up, meet with you at home or here or some other place, wherever you like, whatever time of the day you like, to go through and investigate further. You see, somebody says to me in one of these cards here, please can you give us information, proofs about Jesus Christ? Can't do it all in a short course of lecture. Don't know your particular questions. We need to sit with you and answer your questions, which will be different to the questions of the person beside you. But we're happy to do that with you. At your time, at your convenience, all you need, or just drop some questions on the card here, and we'll write to you about them or ring you up and talk them over with you, whatever they may be. But we want you to investigate. Look at the books we've got for sale at the back, or we've got free up there as well. Take whatever you need to be able to investigate further. We would like you to investigate and like to help you in whatever way. But for some of us, of course, we know it's true. We're like the psychologist. For years and years, we've known it's true, but we've never then done the truthful thing. Namely, to worship him. And so I'm going to finish off really by praying that prayer again today, which is the kind of thing you need to pray if you already know it's true. You know it's the truth, but have not committed your life to the truth that you know. Just look at it there. You see, the first paragraph says, I have been ignoring you. Thank you for forgiving me, says the second paragraph. And finally, please change me, forgive me, and change me that I may live with Jesus as my Lord and Master. You want to pray that your prayer? If that's your prayer, then you might like to pray it in the quietness of your own mind to God as I pray it out loud now. Let's pray. Dear God, I know I'm not worthy to be called a child of God, and I don't deserve your gift of eternal life. I am guilty of rebelling against you and ignoring you, and I need forgiveness. Thank you for sending your Son to die for me, that I may be forgiven, and that you raised Jesus to give me new life. Please forgive me, change me, that I may live with Jesus as my Lord and Master. Amen.